We are actually in Esther chapter 5, and just to catch you up, if you were not here last Thursday night, or if you have bad short and long-term memory, then just to let you know that a man named Mordecai, he is a Jewish man, he refused to bow when a man named Haman had been exalted to second position in the kingdom, second only to King Ahasuerus in the Persian kingdom. The king had given the order that any time Haman passed by, that everybody had to bow, not out of respect, but actually in worship, to pay homage to Haman. And Mordecai had just too many Bible lessons, I guess, when he was a kid, but there was no way he was going to worship anybody but the Lord God, and so he refused to bow. Well, that set Haman off to the point where he didn't just want to see Mordecai killed, he also wanted to see all the Jews. He wanted to make sure that no one would ever refuse to bow and pay homage and worship to him again. So he devised a plan to exterminate all the Jews. He issued a law at the permission of the king. The king said, "Oh, I don't care what you do. Here's the royal seal, signet ring. Put a stamp on whatever you want. I trust you." So the law that was issued was on the 13th day of the month of Adar. That's the 12th month. Then everybody in the Persian kingdom needs to take up arms against the Jews. You're allowed to kill the Jews and take everything, take their homes, take their property, take everything that they have, go ahead and kill them. Well, that sent certainly the capital city of Shushan into an uproar. And then as the Pony Express was taking that message to all the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Persia, the Jewish people were upset. They were crying. They were weeping. They were wearing sackcloth and ashes. Now, it just so happens, and a lot of things in the book of Esther have that quote-unquote just so happens. You know that coincidence, according to the rabbis, coincidence is not a kosher word. And because there's no such thing as coincidence in the kingdom of God, God orchestrates these things. So as we read in the book of Esther these things and we say, oh, it just so happens this and it just happened to be that, we know that God is working behind the scenes. Well, it just so happens that the king in his sinful drunkenness had banished the queen that he had, Vashti, a very beautiful woman. She refused to show her beauty to all the drunken men of the town, and so he had her banished. And about 4 years later, he was feeling pretty lonely and decided to listen to his counselors, who said, "Why don't you get all the most beautiful virgins in the whole empire, have them rounded up, and then you could meet one a night until you find the one that you'd like to be your queen?" And he thought that was a great idea. Turned out that the one that he decided to make queen was Esther. Just so happened to be Mordecai's adopted daughter. Technically, they were cousins, but when her parents died, he adopted her as the daughter. So she's now Queen Esther, and Mordecai, this guy who's in trouble and who seems to have gotten every Jewish person in the Persian Empire in trouble by refusing to bow, her adopted father. Well, he gets a hold of her and said, "Haven't you been reading the news?" Well, no, they don't bring the newspaper in here. "Well, this is what's going on. All the Jews are going to be killed in about 11 months, and what are you going to do about it? You're the queen. Go talk to the king." "Well, you don't understand the way it works, Pops. I mean, the fact is that I haven't seen the king in a month, and if I go in there without being summoned, then the law is that I be put to death." That was the law for anyone and everyone, that as soon as they walked into the throne room, unless they had been specifically summoned by the king, they would be immediately put to death. Well, there is an exception there, that if the king quickly recognizes that he would, in fact, like to see the person, then the golden scepter, which is in his hand, he can extend that out. But, I mean, he never does that. Everybody dies. Everybody who's foolish enough to walk in there, "You're asking me to kill myself," is what you're asking me. And her adopted father, Mordecai, said, "You know, here's the deal. Don't think that by being in the palace, you're going to escape this law. The fact is that the deliverance of the Jews is going to raise up somehow, whether through you or somebody else. But Could it be that for such a time as this, you have been made queen of Persia? She said, okay, I can accept that. Here's the deal. I'll go, I'll talk to him I'll try and talk to him, and if I perish, I perish. But you guys have to do me a favor. You need to fast for 3 days, and I'll fast, and my maidens will fast, and we'll have a 3-day fast, and then I will go and walk into the throne room, and if I die, I die. So that's where we left off there, that it says in chapter 5 in verse 1, now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And it happened when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Well, it turns out that, in fact, he did extend the scepter. The cliffhanger, if you read ahead, wasn't much of a cliffhanger that you've been waiting all week to find out because you had the Bible in your hand. But it was pretty touch and go for her. She was assuming that she was going to be killed instantly. And when she saw that scepter extended, then she knew that that was life. Now, interestingly enough, historically, throughout the ages and throughout the kingdoms, universally, the scepter that the king held did, in fact, stand for more than just some kind of decoration. It was not just something that looked really good when they buried the Egyptian kings and they had the little thing in one hand and the other. It wasn't just for symmetry. The scepter that the kings held, in fact, were the nation's symbols of life and death, of power and authority, specifically the authority as almost as gods over life and death. It was the nation's symbol of the power to administer capital punishment to their citizens. So whether you would think that the scepter might have a little electric chair on the top or a little lethal injection syringe or something, you could picture it that way. That is, in fact, what these things represented. And when Esther touched the top of it, she was recognizing, wow, you just saved my life. That if you had not extended this, then I would have been instantly killed. Now, it's important to know that, and I'm not just going through this detail to show off a knowledge of history. It's actually important for you to know this because a very, very important prophecy in the book of Genesis centers around this historical fact. And that is in Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob is prophesying over each of his sons. He gets to Judah. And Judah is prophesied over this. This is in Genesis 49:10. That Jacob spoke this over his son Judah. He says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Now, all throughout the ages, the Jews recognized Shiloh as Messiah. Shiloh is a title of someone, meaning one who brings peace. And in the language, in the original language, it's very clear that it's to Shiloh shall be the obedience of the peoples. And so they realized all throughout the ages that when Messiah or Mashiach or Christos or Christ, as we call him today, that when Christ would appear, that when he appeared, the scepter would have not departed from Judah. In other words, Judah's right to rule, specifically to administer capital punishment through stoning to the Jews, to their own people, would not depart. Never would the Jews' right to administer capital punishment be taken away until Messiah appeared. Now, that was very interesting because even on through the ages, even until the time of the New Testament, when Mary and Joseph were alive, that Judah retained that right. They had their own Supreme Court. Even though they had been conquered by the Roman Empire and were under Roman occupation, they were still allowed to administer justice and judgment, even of capital punishment, putting someone to death, to their own people. And they would do this through stoning. But at one point, this is historically known, in 30 AD, the Roman powers that be got really tired of the Jews always getting angry and throwing rocks at people and killing them. And so they said, okay, this is too much. This is causing too much problem. And they issued a decree, a law against the Supreme Court, saying you are still allowed to have trials and such, but no more death penalties. This is not allowed. And when that decree was issued, the high priest actually tore his robes, put ashes on his head, and went through the streets of Jerusalem weeping and wailing, mourning the fact that the word of God had been broken. Because clearly, Messiah, Shiloh, one who brings peace, had not yet come. Well, he was obviously mistaken. It was 30 AD. Jesus Christ was already on the scene, gathering huge crowds to himself and preaching what? Preaching Shiloh, preaching peace to the peoples and peace with God. And so here, the high priest, a man of such great position but of such little faith, although he did not see, he should have trusted the word of God. And that's what I found to be true time and time again, is regardless of what we see with our eyes, if we continue to trust that what the word says is true, soon we will find out the facts. Soon the information that we need will come to light to where we realize, oh, wow, that was true. I almost had a crisis of faith. I almost thought the word of God wasn't faithful. I almost thought that the word of God was broken, but in fact, I just didn't have all the information. And so here's King Ahasuerus. He extends the scepter, saving Queen Esther's life. She touches it. She's very thankful that he has extended this. And one more point that I would bring out to you too. This was indeed a very sore point for the Jews for years afterwards. From 30 AD until the destruction and decimation of Jerusalem in 70 AD, for 40 years the Jews never got over this, and it was a big part of the rebellion that the Jews had against the Roman government, was their having taken away their sovereignty. And you see this coming through even when Jesus, 3 years after the decree was issued, 3 years later, Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he goes through a number of trials. And if you read through the Gospels, you'll see he's got these trials before these different religious leaders. And they finally come to the conclusion that, well, yeah, he's guilty regardless of the facts. I mean, now we've got some false eyewitnesses saying that he was going to destroy the temple and all sorts of things. But the fact is, we want him dead, and we can't put him to death. So what did they do? They took him to Pilate, the governor of the region there that they lived in, the Roman authority, and they said, you need to put this man on trial. And he said, well, take him yourselves, judge him yourselves. What do I have to do with this? You know, judge him according to your law. And they said, well, we aren't allowed to put anybody to death. So even before the Romans having found him guilty of whatever it was he was supposed to be guilty of, they had already determined the sentence would be death. And you can see them even copping an attitude with the governor saying, well, we aren't allowed to put anyone to death, which is why they took him to the Roman governor Pilate. Well, anyway, King Ahasuerus did have the power over life and death. He spared Esther's life here. And we see in verse 3 that the king said to her, what is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it will be given to you. And Esther said, if it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Then the king said, bring them on quickly, that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. And as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, by the way, I want you to notice that every time we see the king, he's always drinking, you know, which is not a positive quality in a world ruler. And even to half the kingdom, so Esther answered, said, oh, where am I? Verse 6, as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. So Esther answered and said, my petition and my request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow, and we'll do as the king says. Well, we see that the king obviously knew that the fact that Esther walked in under the threat of death that she walked in, he knew something was up. He said, "What's troubling you? What's your petition? What's your request? Hey, I like you. Up to half the kingdom, whatever you want, it's yours." By the way, you'll see people in authority in various kingdoms in the Bible making these promises. Up to half of my kingdom, I will give it to you. That is because the law dictated that the king always had to be in control of 51% of the kingdom. That's what, that was the most they could do. So whereas we might say, anything in the world, honey, anything at all, they couldn't say that. Even up to half the kingdom, that's the most they could promise. Well, what would you like? This banquet idea. She didn't come right out and say, well, this guy Haman, he's passed this law. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but, you know, and I know I haven't told you that I'm a Jew, but by the way, I am. And we're all going to die in about 11 months. And what's up with that? She didn't do that. Instead, she came up with this idea of the banquet. Now, I don't know if she was trying to soften him up. It very well could be that, remember, she had been fasting for 3 days. I would tell you, but I'm famished, kingy boy. So come on to dinner and I'll tell you about it. Well, notice that she's already prepared this. Have you ever tried to prepare food on an empty stomach? Oh, man. I love catching things like that in the Bible. They just make me go, wow, this was a righteous woman. You know, she didn't eat while she was cooking. Anyway, her idea, for whatever reason, maybe she was just putting it off. Maybe she was trying to build up the courage to present this to the king. But for whatever reason, she said, well, you and Haman, come to dinner. I've made this banquet. And so the king knew that the request wasn't, please have dinner with me. The request of the queen was, I will tell you what's troubling me at the banquet. So the banquet comes. He says, okay, what's your petition? What's your request? And she thinks, well, this was pretty good. Let's go two for two here. Let's have another banquet. And that's all I'm going to ask you tonight is, will you please come back for dinner tomorrow? Well, I don't know why she did it this way, but she could not have possibly orchestrated such a perfect response from Haman that night. Because what we see in verse 9 is that Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. Remember, this guy is wicked. This guy is so wicked that in synagogues, when the book of Esther is read during the Feast of Purim, that every time the word Haman is mentioned in the synagogue, all the Jews in the pews, all the folks hiss and stamp their feet. He's so wicked. And so he goes out that day and he's all happy with himself. But then he came across Mordecai in the king's gate. And Mordecai did not stand up or tremble before him. And when that happened, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. You know, these are friends that I don't want a lot of. You know, hey, why don't you come on over to my house? Oh, sure. Hey, Haman, what's up? Like, is it a pool party or something? No, I just wanted to tell you how great I am. Let me show you the checkbook balance running in the bank here, and let me tell you about my great family, how much bigger it is than yours, and let me actually tell you about how exalted I am in the kingdom. And, oh, by the way, the king gave me another medal the other day, and why don't I show that to you? And have I mentioned how good-looking I am? You know, who needs friends like this? I don't want people like that to be my friends. Call me up, come over, and let me tell you about myself, how good I am. And so he's trying, but he's angry. He went out, you know, he just had dinner with the king and queen, just the three of them, just the three, you know, head honchos of the kingdom there, us three. And then Mordecai, he won't stand up, and he's mad, and so now he's looking for a pride boost or something, calls his friends over, and he says this, as he's recounting to all these things, and he says, oh, you know, in verse 12, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. It's important that we don't miss this. It's very important that we as Americans, and especially we as American Christians, don't miss this. Because I have found that the same percentage of Christians as non-Christians in America are spending their time chasing the buck and chasing the power and trying to be upwardly mobile and trying to get the raise and trying to get the better car and trying to get the little bigger house, a little better neighborhood, or trying to get the one more department under my management or whatever it might be, that there's a whole lot of people, Christians included, thinking that they're going to find satisfaction if they get just a little more money, just a little more influence, just a little more power, just a little more recognition, just a little more fame, just a few more sales accounts, just another car, just a faster car, just another whatever. And it's a deadly trap, because no matter how high you advance, no matter how much money you begin to make, no matter how many people you manage over, no matter how big your business gets, no matter how much you attain what you've been seeking for, the satisfaction that you find from it goes, it's gone. It's gone. You have it and you're happy, and then you see, oh man, there was that one more thing. I knew I should have gotten the genuine leather seats. Oh man. Oh, you know, there's not enough bathrooms in this house. Or, well, now I got this job, but I see this other guy. He's got one more department than me. And people that attain and gain and gain and get, they get to a point where they will never get any more. They have more than they could possibly have imagined. Like Haman, look at how much money. Remember when he offered up money to the king to pass this law? We saw this last week. He offered so many talents of silver that historically we know how much the Persian Empire took in tariffs and taxes each year. The amount of money that Haman offered to the king was equal to 2/3 of the amount that the entire Persian Empire collected in 1 year. That's how rich this guy was. He was phenomenally rich. He had a very powerful and influential family. Indeed, he was second only to the king, and he had the king wrapped around his little finger. What did he have? Or what did he not have? What had he not attained? He had attained it all. He had gained it all. And guess what? One little Jewish man who wouldn't get up when he passed by, robbed him of all the joy. Took all of it away. Do you realize that no matter how rich you get, no matter how much influence you get, the joy that you think you're getting from it can be taken away like that? All it's going to take is one foolish person not paying attention to the traffic signals to crash into your car. All it's going to take is one bad Burger King drive-up counter person to ruin your day because they salted your French fries when you said no salt, you know? No matter how much influence you get, no matter how much happiness you try to attain, it will be gone in a moment by one person. That's worldly happiness. But the joy that comes from the Lord, as we sang tonight, there's joy in the Lord, and that joy can't be ripped off because the Lord doesn't change. Restore to me, David said, the joy of thy salvation. You know what? God hasn't changed, and neither has the nature of salvation. And so that joy doesn't change, regardless of how good or bad things seem to be going on earth. And so we wonder why Jesus spent so much time talking about how we're wasting our time laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven. Laying up for ourselves treasures on earth, when in fact we should be laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven, because that's where real satisfaction is going to come from. And that's where the real joy is going to come from. And so we're reminded that Jesus said in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. They're the ones that are going to be satisfied, the ones that are hungering and thirsting after righteousness. Well, they came up with an idea. They said, you know, none of this satisfies me. He was looking for satisfaction in the wrong place. He was looking for it in the world. None of this satisfies me. But then Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, well, have a gallows 50 cubits high. Remember, a cubit was 18 inches, basically the measure of a man's elbow to the tip of his middle finger, about 18 inches, a foot and a half. So you can multiply that, 50 times a foot and a half. What is that? 75 feet high. And now you're all impressed with my math ability. I can also add quarters. Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. Oh, dear. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. The idea that he could have a man hanged, which is a gross thing. If you've ever seen film from third world countries of people being executed, it's just a horrible thing. It makes your stomach turn. It reminds me of, and I'm not really allowed to say who it was, but somebody in my family and I attended a surgical procedure on an animal at the invite of a veterinarian. And as I'm watching this and I'm getting kind of loopy and feeling a little sick and leaning against the wall, the family member that came with me turned to me and said, let's go to Subway for lunch. Some people can, you know, see stuff like that and then eat. Apparently Haman was a man like that. I don't think I could do that. But Zeresh, I don't want you to forget this fact, because it's going to play out in a little bit longer here. Zeresh and his wife and all his friends are going, oh yeah, Mordecai the Jew, just go ahead and build this 75-foot high gallows and have him put to death. That's a great idea. Yeah, you should really go do that. And that's going to turn out to be quite the twist of fate there. So what happens next is what I like to call a God thing. Chapter 6. It just so happens, during that night the king could not sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written what Mordecai had reported considering Bigthanah and Teresh. Remember these two bad guys from chapter 2. Two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So there's this Bigthanah and Teresh, the two guys that were angry about something and they were plotting to kill the king. And they said, okay, this is how it's going to go. Well, Mordecai, you remember, he pretty much lived his life there at the king's gate and never missed a word. And so when he overheard that, he said, hey, tell Queen Esther that I just heard this and tell her to tell the king. And so anyway, it was found out, and these guys were, it was investigated that, found out it was a real plot, and they were put to death. Well, it turns out that it was written down in the book, this good deed saved the life of the king, written down in the book, and then Mordecai was promptly forgotten. He was never recognized for this. He never got the Good Citizens Award or anything. He never got the $1,000 from the Silent Witness Crime of the Week or anything. And I want you to notice, too, before we continue on, that next time you're having trouble sleeping, why don't you ask God, is it because you're trying to tell me something? Is it just because I need a warm glass of milk? Or maybe I'm supposed to pray, or maybe I'm supposed to read my Bible, or maybe I'm supposed to be interceding for somebody. You know, isn't it just possible that the reason you can't sleep, well, it's because the air conditioning's broken, but also, it could just be the Lord. Well, in this case, it was the Lord, because the king... Now, the king couldn't sleep, and so what he decided to do was have this history book read to him. You know, it was the history of the kingdom. Now, you say, why in the world, in the middle of the night, would you want somebody to come and read this book to you? Ask any high school student. Nothing puts you to sleep faster than reading a history book, right? I mean, I know that for a fact for my U.S. history class and civics and the rest of it. Man, that'll put me to sleep faster than anything. But in this case, he wasn't sleepy yet, and he was actually listening, and he said, well, go on. See, they said, oh, and it was investigated, the guys were put to death. And then it started with the next door, and he goes, hold on, time out, guys. Whatever happened to this Mordecai guy? What did he get? I mean, did we buy him a house? Did we give him the Good Citizens Award? What's the deal? And he says, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Well, the king's servants who attended him said, well, nothing. Nothing has been done for him. Well, the king couldn't let that happen. And so he says, who is in the court? You know, it's the middle of the night, but there's got to be... So one of my employees has got to be around. Who's in the court? Well, it just so happens that Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. And the king's servants said to him, well, behold, Haman is standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. Well, Haman wanted to talk to the king, and the king wanted to talk to Haman. They both wanted to talk to each other about Mordecai. There was a little bit of difference in the subject matter of him, but Haman came in, and the king said to him, oh, what is to be done for the... Haman came into the king and asked Haman, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? Haman's thinking, the king just sent for me. I'm like the most special guy in the whole kingdom. You know, I'm the guy having dinner, you know, last night and tomorrow night with king and queen. Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Now that's a man who's humble, you know? Wow. And so he's thinking, okay, the king doesn't know that I know, but I know. But see, Haman didn't know, and the king did know. He's thinking that he's being asked about some indifferent third party. I want to honor a man. What should I do? Haman's thinking, it's really for me. I'm going to make this good. Basically, I've been given a blank check as a present to me. I'm getting to pick out my own Christmas present. This is awesome. So he says, oh, well, for the man whom the king desires to honor, you know, this other guy, of course, well, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn and the horse on which the king has ridden and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. What a great plan. Write your own ticket. The king doesn't know that I'm giving him exactly what I think would be great, and I know it's for me, and oh, this is going to be great. The king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horses you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Oh, man, I wish there was a camera, a video camera on his face. That would have been great. I wish there was a video camera on my face just now. That would have been good, too. And he says, and do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king deserves to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. And you know that he sat down. Hey, Haman, I'm sitting. Why don't you walk by me a few more times? I'm sitting. Well, Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. Now, interestingly enough, it says that Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, who still happened to be there, you know, it's like, we had to listen to your husband bragging about himself. The least you can do is feed us and put us up for the night. He either had a really big house or not very many friends. I love this. Zeresh and his friends hear from Haman what happened. Oh, man, this is what happened. I hate that guy. I can't believe it. This is terrible. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, well, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Now, that's not what you guys said the other night. I said, Mordecai the Jew. You guys said, oh, build the gallows, hang him on it, ask the king. And now you're telling me, oh, Mordecai is a Jew? Oh, yeah, you don't have a chance. Yeah, thanks for presenting all the information to me. Oh, goodness. These are great friends. And you got to put a plug in for the wife, Zeresh, there, too. Well, they certainly knew the truth. Even if they didn't present all the information at the end of chapter 5, but waited till the end of chapter 6, even so, they knew the truth. Look at what they said. If Mordecai, from before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Even the Persians knew that you cannot oppose God's people and expect to live. You cannot come against God's chosen nation of Israel, God's chosen people, the Jews. You cannot come against them and expect to prosper. No, in fact, you will be cursed. God promised, beginning in the book of Genesis and then on through the scriptures, he proved it out. That in Genesis 12, God told Abraham and his descendants, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. I will bless those that bless you, and he who curses you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Well, the most important, poignant part that Haman should have tuned into there was the one who curses you, I will curse. See, all his friends seem to know this. His wife seemed to know that. Oh, he's a Jew. Oh, well, see, that changes things. Haven't you heard what happened? Haven't you ever read the history books? Don't you remember what happened to the Egyptian army, the most powerful army in history? When they tried to kill the Jews, they were all drowned in the Red Sea. And then when the Amalekites came against the Jews as they were headed on the way to Canaan, oh, they were all wiped out, weren't they? And then the Philistines and the Canaanites and the rest of all the inhabitants of this land that they would occupy, they were all wiped out. They could not stand before the Jews or the God of the Jews. And remember when the Assyrians carried half of them off into a captivity? What happened to the Assyrians? Wiped out. Remember the kingdom that came before us? The Babylonians, remember? Like they were the dynasty right before us. They carried all the Jews off into captivity. What happened to them? Wiped out in one night. The whole lot of them wiped out in one night. Oh, Haman. If you had only read your history books, you would know that you can't come against the Jews and expect to prosper. No wonder you've begun to fall. No wonder things are going badly. No wonder this isn't happening your way. Oh, you don't have a chance. Well, I praise God that they don't have a chance. As I follow the news and I listen to all this rhetoric back and forth about the Middle East and what Israel should do to bring peace to the Middle East and all these concessions they need to make, and woe if it would be so good if Israel would just drop off the face of the earth and all the Arabs and the Muslims could all have that whole area and they'd be so happy. You know, Zeresh, Haman's wife, and his wise counselors all knew what the Palestinians haven't figured out yet. You can't stand against the Jews for any length of time before God smites you. And the European Union is going to learn that as well. And the United Nations is going to find that out the hard way. That you cannot curse God's people and expect to survive. Now, certainly not calling us all to, you know, start suicide bombing the Palestinians or committing acts of terrorism against the UN buildings or going to Europe and start trying to do covert operations there, because we don't have to do any of that. All we have to do is pray and say, Lord, I know you're watching all this. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And God has promised. And even if he waits, even if he delays that judgment until all the nations of the earth are gathered against Jerusalem, as we saw late in the book of Zechariah, that is happening. It will happen someday quite soon. God's going to show up in person for that one. And, I mean, all the Palestinians that remain in that day are going to wish that they had been suicide bombers, because now they're going to be facing God face to face on earth instead of just at the judgment seat. And it's going to be very, very brutal, but very, very just. Oh, Haman, don't you understand? Mordecai is a Jew. If he's of Jewish origin, you can't stand against him. In fact, you will be cursed. You will fall. Well, the nations of the earth are going to find that out. Verse 14 of chapter 6. Turns out that Haman had let time get away from him. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Oh man, is it dinner time already? I'm still full. Well, now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. You see that again. And the king said to Esther on the second day as they drank their wine at the banquet, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom, it shall be done." Well, the king's interest has been piqued. She wouldn't tell him in the throne room. She wouldn't tell him yesterday at the banquet. Now, come on, you got to tell me, really. I mean, anything you say there. Well, Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people is my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." Well, no doubt at this point, the king was quite confused. Okay, your petition is for your life and for your people. I'm not following this. I don't really get this. You see, the king did not know that she was a Jewess. The king was not familiar with her lineage. And he probably wasn't even really keeping up on the destruction of this people that didn't obey the laws. I mean, he had turned that duty over to Haman. And so he's probably just, okay, your life and your people and what are you talking about? They've been sold for destruction and to be killed and for annihilation. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus?" And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. Now, I want you to picture this, because Haman is such a bozo that he's sitting here listening to this going, Queen Esther's begging for her life and her people have been sold to be annihilated. I'm not following this. It wasn't until she said, "It's him!" And then he realized, oh. Oh, you're a Jew. Wait, if they ever make a movie out of this, they're going to have to get a really good actor to play this guy. Tim Curry. Am I right? He'd be the perfect Haman. That just struck me. I like that. Well, the king arose in his anger from drinking wine. You got to love this guy. He keeps DTs in business or something, but He arose in his anger and from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. That was an understatement. Now, when the king returned from the palace garden into the palace where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Bad move. If you ever want to beg for your life from a queen, get down on your knees where you are. Don't go to her couch and lay on it. That's like really bad news, because the king walks in and sees this, and, you know, and he's a little tipsy and he's really angry. So he says, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Well, remember that there were servants there, the eunuchs there, that watched the king all the time. They were standing there silently on the outskirts of the edges of the room there. And as soon as they heard the king say this, they grabbed him and they covered his head. Well, then Harbona, one of these eunuchs who was before the king, he had been silently watching this whole thing, and he just couldn't help but offer what he thought was a pertinent piece of information that he thought the king should know. "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high," which Haman made for Mordecai, by the way, you know, who spoke for good on behalf of the king. Just couldn't help but point that out to you there, kingly boy. And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. You know, all through the Bible, we find statements like Solomon wrote in Proverbs 26, 27, "He who digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone, it will come back on him. He won't get no satisfaction." I added that last part, by the way. David prayed in Psalm 9, "The nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made. In the net which they hid, their own foot has been caught. The Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. In the work of his own hands, the wicked is snared." You know, the next time you're in a panic because the neighbor has it out for you, because the guy in the next cubicle wants to see you fired and he's doing everything he can, don't freak out. Don't stress out. Just pray, "Lord, he's rolling a stone, and I know it's going to roll back on him. He's trying to catch me in the net. Let his foot be caught in it. Lord, he's dug a pit for me. He's waiting for me to fall in it. Lord, would you make sure that he falls in it instead? I trust that you'll make that happen." It certainly happened to Haman. "Construct a gallows," he said. And now his lifeless body is hanging from it. Well, how true it is that when people come against God's people, when enemies come against God's people, very often the judgment that they tried to inflict in the very same way, then it's brought back upon them. Well, we'll only look at the first two verses of chapter 8. "On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther." She evicted all the friends and the wife, I'm assuming. "And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her." Oh, by the way, this guy's my dad. I thought you ought to know. "And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman." That's good. "And gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman." Well, happily ever after, right? Everything's going pretty good. The king's doing good, Mordecai's doing good, Esther's doing good. And it would be a happily ever after story, except for the fact that when the king of Persia made a law, it could not be revoked or repealed, even by the king who had made the law. I guess it was just their built-in way of making sure that frivolous laws weren't passed. You remember, you're stuck with this forever. So the calendar is ticking. Sorry to mix metaphors there. The clock is ticking. The calendar pages are turning. The 13th day of the month of Adar, the 12th month, is rapidly approaching, and the law is still in effect that all the citizens of the Persian Empire are going to take up arms against the defenseless Jews and kill them to take all their stuff. So that's our cliffhanger for the week. I encourage you to read ahead, and not just to read ahead, but to go back and read the whole thing all the way through. We'll finish the book next Thursday night, but for now, let's go to the Lord in prayer.